Welcome to the Fuller Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 8:49 British Summer Time. Today is July 12th. Today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio for the various different asset classes. Now, if we have a review of what's been happening this week, then this has been an important week from the perspective of stock markets. The S&P 500 moved to a new closing high yesterday and is closing out the week pretty close to that. It's up less than 1 point. As we approach the close here on Friday. The Nasdaq 100 moved to a new recovery high. The Russell 2000 moved on to new all-time highs this week and have more or less held on to their advances so far. We are now presented with, just as we were presented 3 weeks ago with short-term oversold conditions, we are presented today with short-term overbought conditions, and the potential for some consolidation of recent gains has increased quite substantially. In the autonomy sector, we've seen that there has been that mean reversion has been by far the most important trend over the last 2 months. And the vast majority of those types of companies have pulled back to the region of their 200-day moving averages, an increasing number of them have bounced. And that is also where some of the most consistent trends remain evident. So we are back at interesting levels for a large number of the types of companies that we favor over the medium term. In the currency markets, this was also a week full of action. Following Ben Bernanke's rather dovish statement on Wednesday, the dollar fell back really quite abruptly, and not least against the euro. When we look at the dollar index, which is predominantly euro, then the index had got right up to a previous area of resistance and encountered resistance there again in here this week and pulled back sharply. Now, considering that the degree to which we automated and programmed traders are present in the markets, that was almost like hitting a switch. And dollar weakness, we've had dollar strength being the dominant theme for the last 2 months, and we've had a significant rally in various dollar spot rates right around the world, but probably most acutely in commodity producers and in the emerging markets. And following Mr. Bernanke's dovish statement, the dollar pulled back against a significant number of those currencies, and where it pulled back most, we saw the greatest bounce. And a number of those emerging market stock markets were back in areas of potential support and back testing previous lows. And we've had a quite impressive bounce in the latter 2 days of this week. And just as the dollar had a short-term overbought condition, a sizable number of those markets had short-term oversold conditions. So there is the potential for an additional bounce in here. And the Indian market in particular stands out because no country or no currency had fallen more than the rupee against the US dollar. And the fact that the rupee has steadied up has been a tailwind for the Indian stock market, which was stronger again in here today. Just in the government bonds sector, now we've had significant deterioration in government bonds, corporate bonds, and municipal bonds over the last 2 months. And when we look at the total return index and the Merrill Lynch 10-year plus total return index has been our bellwether for the treasury market for really the last 3 or 4 years. And the reason for that is because so many fixed income investors do so from a yield perspective and a yield to maturity basis. And they have been paid and they've been making money with a winning strategy since the early 1980s, and that has been to buy the dips. So every time yields have gone up somewhat, they've marched right in and been buying treasuries, and they've done very well from it. And that created, on a total return basis, one of the most consistent trends in any asset class ever. So we've been watching that trend, and while we've been leery of government bonds, we haven't really had any great evidence in terms of that trend to back up our bearish view. But what we've now seen is a failed upside break. Then it returned to test the lower side of the range. Then it broke lower. It's pulled back below the 200-day moving average. It's pulled back into the underlying trading range. And these all represent really quite large inconsistencies for what had previously been one of the most consistent trends of any asset class anywhere. And even yet, we're seeing a huge amount of disagreement in the government bond markets as to exactly where we are with these markets. And I've seen more than a few commentators who have begun to adopt the line, yes, I understand the bearish arguments, but we've got a few more months left, don't we? And that would be the type of commentary we would associate with major market tops. And we'll have outright confirmation that government bonds' secular bull market is actually over on the next rally, if that total return index encounters resistance anywhere below or in the region of 2000, then we will have pretty firm confirmation that the bull market in US Treasuries is over, that we can expect higher yields right across the fixed income sector, and that there are going to be two ways that that's going to be interpreted. One is that there's potentially going to be additional inflation. And the other is that central banks wouldn't be giving up on quantitative easing or talking about tapering or removing quantitative easing. In other words, they wouldn't be removing their extraordinary monetary stimulus unless they were pretty sure that growth was likely to come back onto a self-sustained footing. And that is by far the most dovish interpretation. And of course, we could be in for a little bit of both. But it means that when we think about the investment strategies that have worked over the last, not just the last few years, but over the last decades, then, and we take asset classes one at a time, then in the fixed income markets, people have really, the winning strategy has been to buy the dips. And that's not going to work if the secular bull market is over. It means that really what one is looking for is an asset class that has the potential to increase dividends at a rate above inflation or above that at which the yield on government paper is rising. Now, that means that one is either going to have to go really short term in terms of the duration of one's bond portfolio, or one is going to have to buy some form of hedge against rising interest rates and rising yields, or one buys equities. And not just any equities, but equities that have a solid record of increasing dividends above the rate of inflation. And really, we've been concentrating on those types of companies for the last 3 to 4 years. And a large number of those types of companies are included in our list of autonomies. And we define autonomies as the types of companies that have a global reach, that are truly global in that their revenue is sourced from a range of different countries and geographic regions. So they are some of the big multinational type companies. And many of them have long records of increasing dividends. And they have strong brand recognition. So they're the leaders in their respective sectors. And because they have these large global franchises, they have strength in their cash flows. They have leverage to the growth of the global consumer or to the productivity gains that are going to come through from technological innovation. And they're also some of the companies that are going to benefit most from lower energy prices coming through in the latter half of this decade and into the next decade. When we think about where equity markets have been trading for the last number of years, then Wall Street spent 13 years ranging from the 1999-2000 peak, and it's broken out to new all-time highs in the last 3 months. And the last time we saw something like this happening was really back in 1980. The market had been ranging for the better part of 15 years. The Dow Jones was ranging more or less below 1,000 for the entire time. It was an incredibly volatile, massive range. Then you had this powerful breakout. And valuations didn't bottom until 1982. So we had 2 years of ranging following the breakout, which allowed the earnings contraction to really climax. And that created the really deep value that fundamental investors have been looking for and have not been finding with the market at today's levels. And the biggest bull markets follow the biggest bear markets. And this generational long process of P/E ratio contraction and rising dividend yields that has been evident, not just on Wall Street, but right across Europe, is in its latter stages. And that really can be viewed as very positive indeed. So the strategy for equities going forward, and particularly those equities that have the capability of raising their dividends above the rate of inflation, will be to buy and hold, and to buy the dips, and to hold on. And that is not the strategy that people have been engaged in with equities for the last 13 years. On the one hand, people have had this incredibly volatile environment, and the volatile environments breed trading strategies, and people engage in swing trading, and they sell their rallies, and they start to buy dips, and then they don't have a great deal of confidence about how long they should hold for, so they sell at the first sign of trouble. And we've had this schizophrenic environment where we had QE1, and we had a massive surge, and with the removal of QE1, we had a steep decline, and with the introduction of QE2 and a massive surge, and the removal of QE2 and a big decline, and then we've had QE3, which has turned into basically what looked like QE forever, and we've had this incredibly steady advance over the last 7 or 8 months. And what we've seen so far is that it's not yet over. But what this really tells us is that people are trading on liquidity. And again, that is a trading strategy. It's not an investment strategy. But if this volatile, difficult environment in stock markets is giving way to what would normally be considered a more homogeneous bull market, then buy and hold will prevail. And when we think about how the stock market has performed against other asset classes, then these long processes of ranging, where people's faith in the ability of the stock market to produce outsized returns deteriorates, well, these give way to massive bull markets. And historically, these types of bull markets last for decades. And that means that if we're now looking at the S&P completing a 13-year range and potentially spending upwards of 18 months to 2 years consolidating above the previous peak, then the 20 years from 2015 onwards could represent a massive bull market in equities, where buying and holding will pay dividends over the long term. And if we are moving into an environment where government bonds are going to underperform and yields are likely to rise, and the best bet in terms of the equity markets are going to be those types of companies that either come through with massive productivity gains because of their new products, their new technologies, or because of the steadiness of their income streams. Then what about commodities, where there is no interest rate? Now, gold has performed incredibly well for the last 11 years, 11 consecutive years of positive advances, and prices have deteriorated by 25% alone this year. And gold is probably the ultimate hedge against deflation, because deflation, the competitiveness of yields deteriorates, and gold, by virtue of the fact that it has no yield, and therefore that yield can't deteriorate, outperforms. But if we're moving into a more inflationary type environment, or at least an environment where interest rates begin to normalize, then the real reason for holding gold is deteriorates. We had a massive move in gold in the 1980s because inflation was a real problem and people had no faith in government bonds. But we're a very long way from the bear market peak, considering that the secular bull market in bonds is only just now potentially peaking. We could be another 10, 15, 20 years before yields get back up to where they were in 1980. So gold is not a competitive asset at this level. And what we've seen is that the ETF holdings of gold, which went from literally nothing in the early part of the bull market in the early 2000s to becoming, I think, the fifth largest holder overall, and that trend continues to deteriorate, suggests that there is a significant liquidation going on in terms of gold holdings. And yes, there are retail investors that are still piling into gold and they're buying at any price. And they are not the most important buyer at the margin, because if they were, they'd be supporting gold prices. And what we're actually seeing is that it is institutional holders of ETFs that are liquidating positions are the swing traders in terms of gold's price. And until that ETF holding of gold starts to turn back upwards and some of those shorts start to get pressured, then gold's ability to sustain a rally beyond some short-term unwinding of oversold conditions is going to be questionable. And I suppose one of the problems for gold is that its industrial uses are reasonably insignificant relative to the investment demand for gold. And all the gold that has been held as an investment represents potential supply. It's not the same type of environment for either platinum or palladium. And platinum was stronger by $40 yesterday, and it could potentially be in the process of posting a failed downside break. An additional follow-through next week would confirm that. There is the potential supply disruptions from the mining negotiations that are beginning today in South Africa. And palladium has got some of the more compelling fundamentals within the precious metals sector, and that has continued to outperform and is now about mid-range. Elsewhere in the commodity complex, we had a phenomenal bull market in industrial resources from the early 2000s. And that was described at Fuller Money as supply inelasticity meets rising demand. But since then, we've had billions invested in new mines and in upgrading infrastructure. And those new mines are starting to come into operation. And not least, Oyu Tolgoi, I'm not going to pronounce that correctly, in Mongolia, which is Rio Tinto's $6 billion investment in copper and gold production, came online for exports this week. And of course, that represents increasing supply. Now, on the other side of that equation, Rio and BHP have been tailing back their investment in Australia, not least because of the additional mining taxes that have been imposed there. But what we're starting to see is that we have this supply situation under control. the price action for the industrial metals does not suggest that there is a deficit of industrial metal out there. And in fact, what we're seeing right now is base formation for a number of these metals, and we're right at the bottom side of that range. And there's ample opportunity for them to rally back up to the upper side of that range, particularly if the dollar weakens additionally from where it has already. But the question being really is whether there is the fundamental demand driver to drive these industrial metal prices up out of these bases is quite questionable. So that suggests that that commodity prices are going to be less of an issue in future than they have been over the last decade. And high commodity prices act as a tax on consumers, and that can be viewed as a positive from the perspective of potential for GDP growth. Of course, oil is a slightly different environment right now, and oil prices have been surging this week. And West Texas Intermediate has pushed back above $100 and is up to about $105 at the close of trading here on Friday. Now, there is a certain amount of a risk premium in oil, but perhaps the much more important aspect is that the supply bottleneck at the Cushing facility in the USA has been eased. And some of the new infrastructure and pipeline reversals have really contributed to that. And it has made U.S. oil fungible on the global market once more. And that has allowed the spread relative to Brent crude to contract, which has meant that WTI prices have been rising rather than Brent crude prices declining. And we're now in a situation where crude oil prices are in backwardation, not just over the front to second month, but right across the futures curve, which suggests a supply deficit. And if we think about what are the potential problems for stock markets and indeed financial markets more generally, then monetary policy and high energy prices are right at the top of the list. And with Mr. Bernanke's dovish comments this week, the chances are that we're not going to see the kind of declines in the short term that we saw it from mid-June through to the end of June. What we are likely to see is probably some additional ranging. But what we're presented with in the oil markets is breakouts from reasonably consistent or reasonably well-defined trading ranges. And those breakouts are continuing to be extended. We haven't had anything in the way of downward dynamics to check them, and that means we have to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. And if we start to see oil prices sustaining in the $120 to $130 area, that is going to represent a significant headwind for the global economy. Now, we've had significant improvement in efficiencies of energy consumption, particularly in the US and Europe over the last few years, not least because it was absolutely essential. But high energy prices are a potential threat, and that is something that is not being priced into stock markets at present at all, and probably is unlikely to be until we start to see oil prices significantly above where they are right now. And in the meantime, that is acting as a tailwind to the energy-related sector, and a large number of particularly U.S. major oil companies have been pushing on to new high ground in the last couple of weeks, and that is really quite bullish action from that asset class. When we think about what are the main drivers, then the product of productivity, or how do we come up with productivity? And the labor market is being driven on the one hand by the fact that we have the rise of the middle class, and that is raising the potential of billions of people to achieve their productive capacity. So that gives us productivity gains in the labor pool on a global basis. Now, one could argue that the jobs report this week in the US saw that lower paid jobs were prevailing and that part-time workers were most of the jobs that were created. And that's all true. But when we look at the global picture, we're seeing labor productivity gains as a significant growth driver. And that productivity is going to be enhanced even further by not just technological innovation, but also the increasing availability of that technology to a much wider demographic. And technology has not only developed to such a stage, but has also become progressively cheaper, so that it is much closer to the spending power of literally billions of new consumers. And that is also likely to improve their productivity. But also, technological innovation is happening at such a progressive rate that it's hard to imagine exactly how this is going to change our lives in future. But what we are seeing in terms of the outperformance of various asset classes is that biotechnology and healthcare and aeronautics and the defense sectors are all doing fantastically well. And these represent the cutting edge of technology. And what looks increasingly likely is that the military-industrial complex is going to become progressively more retail. And the sensors and optics, communications devices, are going to be put into a lot more of the types of things that we use in our daily lives. And that is also going to enhance productivity. And yes, oil prices are a potential threat in the short term, but the supply problems that we've had in the last decade are unlikely to be the types of problems that we're going to be worried about in the next two decades. The oldest adage there is in the commodity markets is that the cure for high prices is high prices, because it creates a supply response. And we are getting that supply response in the commodity markets right now. And it means really that, yes, there are short-term upside risks, and we have to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside for as long as the chart action supports that. But over the medium to longer term, we have such potential to enhance the production of crude oil and natural gas. And the innovation that is going on in the solar sector also has the potential, not in the short term, but potentially in the medium to long term, to enhance our energy goals. And the fourth characteristic that can improve productivity is debt. Now, that's unlikely to be the case in the next bull market, because we've just come through one of the greatest bull markets in debt in history. And in fact, in the next 2 years, the normalization of policy and the shrinking, at least somewhat, of the Fed's balance sheet and the ECB's balance sheet and the Bank of England's balance sheet is likely to pose a threat. And that isn't something that is going to go away anytime soon, and it's going to take time to work through. So the debt issue could delay the arrival of the bullish issues that come through with labor, technology, and energy. And that would fit in rather succinctly into the possibility that the S&P and other major stock markets range for a while before they move into the next secular bull market. And I think with that, I will leave you for the evening, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.